This episode is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management. Experience wealth managers who go above and beyond to guide and support you. CanDo is more than just an attitude. It's navigating today for a brighter tomorrow. Visit candowealth.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by David Miles from the Office of Budget Responsibility and Kate Andrews, the Economics Editor of The Spectator. And we are going to talk about the spring budget. Kate, let's kick off, I think, with the main measures. There was lots of talk in advance about national insurance or income tax, or perhaps both. What did we get?
We got another 2p off employee national insurance. If you combine that with the measures in the autumn statement, this brings it from 12% down to 8%. He's offered up today another £10 billion tax cut, but this was not exactly news, as it was widely expected as of yesterday, really the past few days, that national insurance is what the Chancellor would go for, not least because it was the cheaper option to income tax. A penny off income tax would have required a £7 billion cut, whereas a penny off national insurance required a £5 billion cut. We also had, if there was anything that looked like a rabbit, I suppose it was the changes to child benefits. He is, trying to make that system a bit more fair, changing it from a focus on individual income to household income, and changing thresholds and changing the taper to make that system a bit fairer. You had lots of other things that were already briefed. He has decided to abolish non-domicile tax status, albeit I think that was a softer, more nuanced announcement than many were expecting, and we're going to wait to see the details on that. They're announcing a new kind of regime. And we also have a change to the energy profits levy, the tax on oil and gas companies. That's been extended to 2029. That's not everything the Labour Party was calling for. The Labour Party wanted the effective tax rate to be higher than the 75% it's at now. But you already had a lot of industry asking, is this really a temporary tax measure? And I think those questions will probably get louder now. So some of the things I've just listed there are some of the only things that we've heard from the Labour Party's agenda when it comes to tax. No doubt part of this budget was to make life a bit more difficult for the Labour Party, which will need to come up with new tax promises, something that they haven't exactly wanted to do. And to be fair, why tie yourself to being challenged on a tax promise when nobody's particularly forcing you to? But what I was really looking for today was what was happening to the tax burden, because of course the Tory party wants to say, we're cutting your taxes. And the moment Jeremy Hunt sat down, you got a tweet out from the Conservatives saying, we've cut your taxes, ... again. And Jeremy Hunt was talking about how the effective personal tax rate is now back to its levels, cut to levels that we haven't seen since 1975. But the number I'm looking at is 1948, and that is where the tax burden is heading to, the highest on record since that post-war aftermath. The Tory party may try to say, look, the situation has improved. If we go back to the autumn statement, tax receipts as a percentage of GDP were headed to 37.7%. That was really going to be the record high. That's fallen to 37.1%. But if you look at the graph, it's very clear the tax burden is not falling. It is rising substantially. That makes it a lot harder to craft this narrative that taxes are being cut. Certain taxes are being cut, but the tax burden overall is rising.
David, there are quite a few Tory MPs who in recent months have dreamt of a tax-cutting bonanza fueled by Jeremy Hunt likening himself to Nigel Lawson, even if more recently, as of Sunday, he likened himself to a prudent Gordon Brown. Do you think they got much in the way of tax-cutting bonanza?
Well, I think the situation that faces the government is a difficult one. They're running a fiscal deficit. The stock of debt has been going up and up and up for several years now. It's not far off 100% of GDP. They're trying to turn that around, because you have to turn that around. You can't have the stock of debt relative to GDP just rising and rising and rising. So the question is, what's the least bad way of getting to a situation where the stock of debt is not continuing to rise relative to the incomes of the people of this country? And there's no easy way to do that. What they've done today is announce a set of plans which, as Katie rightly said, mean that the overall tax burden as a percentage of GDP goes up. It doesn't go up a whole lot, but it goes up a bit further from a level that's already higher than it was a few years ago. So that goes up by, between now and 5 years down the road, that continues to rise by another 1% of GDP. So it goes from 36% or so to 37% or so. Highest in 70 years. So that gets you 1% closing the deficit. the other 2% of GDP to close the deficit so that debt doesn't just keep on going up is that government spending relative to GDP will fall by 2% of GDP. So that's the way they've chosen to do something that's really difficult to do and doesn't create any winners, frankly, except if you don't do it, if the counterfactual is you don't care about that, you're on a path that is self-evidently unsustainable. So given no particularly good options, this was the combination of spending decisions, tax decisions that they've hit upon to try and stay within the fiscal target.
And Kate, I want to talk about some of the measures in further detail, including some of the OBR projections. But first off, was there anything notably missing to you when it came to that budget? We mentioned that there's no income tax. That's been pretty well covered. But for example, there was a big push for defence spending. Was there anything that struck out to you as not there that might have been expected to?
I think defence spending is definitely one of them. I think a more generous cut to income or national insurance was expected in a pre-election budget, which raises the question, is this the pre-election budget? Yes, to David's point, you had tax cuts and they're potentially all that Jeremy Hunt could offer up. It's very notable that he is cutting it very fine when it comes to his fiscal headroom. That's down even more. It was about £13 billion to meet his fiscal target in the autumn statement. He's cut that down to about £9 billion. He is cutting it closer than any chancellor dating back to 2010. And he's doing that. He's taking the risk because he wants these tax cuts. So I'm not saying it's easy, but I think people certainly within the Tory party were expecting to see a bit more. And the other thing that the Chancellor sort of addressed is public spending in the next Parliament. So there was some expectation that he would reduce the extent to which it went up in real terms even further, maybe down to 0.75%. He's stuck at 1%, but according to the Institute of Fiscal Studies, that is still roughly a £20 billion black hole, which he muttered about productivity today. To be fair to the Chancellor, and I think he's right about this, better productivity gains in the public sector could fill some of that black hole, but nobody wants to talk about where that money might come from, and we got no indication about that today. Very quickly, what I would say is where we've seen top-ups, where we have seen he's actually been able to get this money for these tax cuts is by giving with one hand and taking with the other. The real culprit continues to be that fiscal drag, that freeze on tax thresholds that is pulling millions more people into paying tax, into paying the higher rate of tax. The OBR now estimates that by 2028-29, that will raise about an additional £40 billion. Compare that to the £10 billion tax cut for NI. This is a tax rise that is four times bigger than the tax cut. You know, I was expecting to see that in the figures, but we still see absolutely no change at all there. And we know that's what's really doing the damage when it comes to the tax burden.
Kate mentioned there, David, this fact that Jeremy Hunt was under pressure to go wider with those tax cuts. I spoke to MPs, as you know, close to the budget, as you know, 11 a.m. Wednesday morning. He was saying, no, we think the budget bunny is an income tax cut. Saying, I don't think it is. But there really was a sense, perhaps, of being so smart by briefing everything out, bar this one thing. And actually, as you said earlier, Kate, probably the closest thing to the bunny was the benefit, the family benefit announcement. But some of these MPs will say Jeremy Hunt should not have allowed himself to get boxed in by the OBR. And you look at the way that the OBR counts things, if you look at the orthodoxy, as Liz Truss used to say, this has meant that they didn't have many options. What would you say to them?
Well, part of the criticism of the OBR, which I think is a bit misplaced, is that we don't allow for any positive side effects of tax cuts. Maybe they give people some more money, but we don't allow that to have any positive impact on the supply potential of the economy. And that's not true. Today's announcement about the NICS cut, the national insurance cut, we've estimated increases the size of the labour force in the UK, the number of people working by 100,000. We thought that the national insurance cut back in November also did 100,000. That's 200,000 more people working because of the tax cut. That increases the potential output in the UK, generates tax revenue to offset slightly the lost revenue from cutting the rate itself. So, I mean, I understand the frustration with the OBR because it sometimes can look like, oh, the Chancellor wants to do all these things and grumpy old OBR just says, no, you can't do that. It's too expensive. You can't do that. But the reality is that there's a reason why the government's got a fiscal target, and I think it's a very powerful reason, which is that you really can't let the stock of debt just carry on going up and going up faster than the income of this country, because it's the income of this country that's the only way that pays for the debt and pays the interest on the debt. And if you're in a situation where you've got to make fiscal policy close the gap between spending and tax revenue, there aren't going to be any easy and nice options.
Also, one of the difficulties here is what Liz Truss and her 49-day premiership did to the relationship between the state and the OBR, I think has made things a lot worse. It shouldn't be the case that you are boxed in by the OBR. It's a forecast. It's a powerful forecast, but there are lots of independent forecasters too. And it should be possible, especially if we're getting into the nitty-gritty of the calculations and public policy, for the government to come out and say the OBR has forecast X for my tax cut or my change to benefits or whatever it may be. They've estimated X, we think Y, and we're going to see what plays out. We're going to see how it works. But because of the chaos that was created back in autumn 2022, I think that's actually made the OBR a bit more powerful. And I think ministers, Jeremy Hunt included, Rishi Sunak included, are probably increasingly nervous about clashing with the OBR in a way that I think would be quite healthy. Again, not across the board on every single issue and you have radically different forecasts, but it'd be very reasonable to say the OBR forecasts X were more optimistic. Let's see which one is right.
Kate, let's talk about election timing, because certainly this week, every time we've turned on any form of news programme, there is a Labour politician saying, it's going to be May. And you had Jonathan Ashworth, for example, placing quite a low-cost bet compared to Rishi Sunak and his 1,000 bet with Piers Morgan on a flight to Rwanda, but placing a bet with Kay Birdie saying, you know, £10 an election May. Now, of course, the Labour tactic is to try and create all this momentum behind the idea the Tories will go to the polls relatively soon, try to put pressure on, and also mean if they don't, they can say, what a load of chickens. But it seemed to me, and I think speaking to MPs after it, that this budget is not fueling the May talk. Instead, it's suggesting quite the opposite. Would you agree?
I would agree. And I agree with your analysis on this, Katie. And I'd love to hear more from you, because there are two things that stand out to me. Number one, so long as the Labour Party can say that the UK is in technical recession, I don't know why the Tory government would want to go to the
polls.
Yeah,
or Rishi's recession, as they like to call it.
They love to call it Rishi's recession. So why would you opt into that? And it's going to take time. We're just simply not going to get the data showing that the UK has almost certainly already left recession in time for a May election. And the other reason is I think that there are plenty of reasons to say, you know, the economy is going to get worse, things are going to look down, but there are equal number of reasons to say things could start to look better. The main one that jumps out to me is that the Bank of England is likely to slowly but surely start cutting interest rates this spring or summer.
Because we had an inflation announcement in that budget.
And we did have an inflation announcement in that budget that all of the forecasts were wrong. They were too pessimistic. It looks like inflation is returning to target or something close to it by spring. By April, we should see some meaningful change in that data. When the April data comes in, again, these things take a bit more time. And that should create a better situation for Jeremy Hunt. He might have more headroom to play with. And why would you cut yourself off to the option of perhaps delivering that income tax cut that his Tory MPs are desperate to see? But I know you've been writing on this too, Katie.
I have, but I'm first going to go to David, because one of the things I've been writing about is the fact that, you know, there was a political cabinet, I think a few months ago, where you had the party's election strategist saying, there are some economic indicators that are going to move in our favour, but it's going to take time. And that was the argument for autumn. So I wonder, David, can you see those two?
Well, yes. I mean, they're very much in the forecast that we at the OBR put out today. So inflation coming down, you know, quite quickly now on our central forecast anyway. Who knows? You could get blown off course, of course, by this. Who knows what's going to happen to oil and energy prices and what happens in the Middle East. So there's always risks around it. But our central forecast, as Katie was saying, is that inflation comes down, you know, quite quickly now, and maybe at the Bank of England's target level within a few months. That didn't seem likely back in November. It seems much more plausible today. And partly on the back of lower interest rates, I mean, we've already seen interest rates come down a bit relative to the back end of last year. And energy prices a bit lower at the moment, surprisingly in a way, given what's happening in the Middle East. Those are enough, we think, to generate growth in the economy now. Maybe we're already out of recession. We won't know, as Katie said, for a few months because of the lags before you get the GDP estimates. So on the central forecast, things do get better during the course of this year.
And Kate, when we're looking at some of the figures, for example, on, I suppose it felt as though in the autumn statement there was more of a focus on out of work than in this one, but there were flicks to it. What is the data suggesting now?
The OBR is very interesting on worklessness in this assessment because it estimates that the efforts and policy changes that the Tory party has made over the past three fiscal statements should, in theory, get about 300,000 people back into work. However, 100,000 people are offset by this, a third, because of fiscal drag, which I was speaking about before, that the tax incentives for many people just simply aren't going to be there. And we wrote about this for the magazine a few weeks ago. We called it Work Farce, looking at the difficulties of getting people back into work. And there are a myriad of reasons, certainly including the fact that mental health, both within the NHS and within job centres, they simply don't have the means to be treating those many issues, so much of which has popped up from lockdowns and the pandemic. But another issue really is the tax system and the incentives and disincentives within it, which I think the OBR really highlights this time around.
And one other aspect when you're looking at some of the figures in the OBR, which perhaps is less something the Tories would want to talk about during an election, comes to net migration. What are we hearing on now in net migration, where the figures are expected to go?
Well, net migration, as you know, has been extremely high in the last couple of years, 600,000-700,000. Our best guess, I hope it's an educated guess at the OBR, is that it comes down really quite sharply from those levels. I mean, partly it's because of the measures the government itself announced back in December on cutting down on visas available for dependents of students and other measures about increasing salaries that people have to get before they can get a visa to work. And it's partly also because when you get a very substantial surge in migration, as we've clearly had, some of those people do go back after a short while. Students, not all of them go back, but some of them do. And so you'd expect actually the number of people leaving with a slight lag of a couple of years to pick up after you've seen a huge increase in migration, a significant chunk of which is students. So we think that chances are that the levels of inward migration, net inward migration, will fall back really quite quickly from the 700,000 odd level that we've been at, maybe down to 300,000, maybe a bit less within a couple of years. Nonetheless, where it ends up is higher than had seemed likely some months back. So there is net over the next 5 years something like 300,000-350,000 more net migrants coming into the UK than had seemed likely at the back end of last year.
And finally, Kate, looking at some of the revenue raises, as you mentioned, Jeremy Hunt made the decision not to cut future government spending, which I think was certainly something Labour was worried about in terms of further limiting their space if the polls are correct. And of course, they take government whenever the election is. But instead, he went for revenue raises in the form of some taxes, abolishing non-dom status, tax on vapes. There's a business class flight crackdown. Do you think it's fair to level the charge, which some on the right have already done, including some Tory MPs, that these measures can be read as anti-business?
If we look at the amount of money that's being raised through these changes to non-dom status is about 2.7 billion, changes to the energy profits levy, 1.7 billion, changes to air passenger duty, 140 million. The vaping one is what I find most bizarre, given the government really doesn't like smoking to the point where they're trying to outlaw it for the next generation. To tax vapes is a very strange move. That's estimated to raise about half a billion. These are revenue raisers, absolutely, but they're not the really big ones. The really big one is through fiscal drag. And, you know, I think that the emphasis for me here, it's not so much about business. It's more about what this says about the Tory party's overall narrative about tax. You can pick out any of these changes, but can you really come up with an overall narrative, an overall arch about where the Tory party is trying to go? And I think that's quite difficult because, yes, they are cutting individual tax. The closest you can get to a narrative is that they're trying to make work pay better. But that is a bit undermined by the fiscal drag. This is a Tory party that is taxing and spending at record levels, bringing that tax burden to a near record high. And I guess I'll just say it again. Are they going to go into an election with that? And I don't think any particular tax change tells me what the Tory party's thinking, tells me what the Tory party would do in the next parliament. I don't know what David thinks.
Yeah, on that, David, do you think perhaps the biggest risk is effectively the fiscal drag, something Labour plans to keep pushing on? And yes, the Tories can talk now 4p off national insurance, combine those two events, but are most voters really going to feel better off?
Well, it's tricky. It's tricky, again, when you start from a position where the debt has gone up so much, you're still running a fiscal deficit. There are all kinds of pressures on public spending. How do you get back to a more sustainable position? And they've done it through a combination of some further net increases in taxation a bit, and government spending is going to fall by a couple of percent of GDP. And that's all very painful. I think standing back and thinking about why the situation is so difficult, I'd say this, that if you go back, I mean, quite a long time now, if you go back to just before the financial crisis, so what, 15 years ago, and you'd ask most people who think about long-term trends in the economy and where is GDP going to be, they would have come up with an estimate of the level of GDP in the UK now, 15 years later, that is probably about 30% higher than it actually is. Because no one thought that productivity growth for 15 years would be dreadful. And it's been dreadful for 15 years. Now, it's been dreadful in a lot of countries, but it's particularly bad in the UK. So the level of GDP is not 5, 10 or 15% lower than you thought. It's 30% lower. And people's expectations about what the government can do have not fallen by 30%. Mm-hmm. And that's the huge economic, social and political problem we face in the UK.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Kate. And thank you for listening.